From the Sky News Centre at 5, criminology student Stephen Griffiths has been remanded in custody, charged with murdering three women. He's accused of killing the women who all went missing in Bradford. Earlier, when he appeared before magistrates, he was asked to confirm his name and replied, "The Crossbow Cannibal." Our reporter Tom Parmenter is outside Bradford Crown Court, where the 40-year-old has also appeared this afternoon.
This afternoon he was led into court. Again, a packed public gallery and packed press benches and enormous amounts of public interest in this case. He was led in wearing a black shirt with a white t-shirt underneath, looking quite unshaven.
A postman from Cornwall has pleaded guilty to 27 child sex offences. 28-year-old Michael Williams from Penryn has admitted grooming hundreds of children using social networking sites. Two teenagers have each been sentenced to 7 years in young offenders institutions after pushing a firework through the letterbox of a mother of nine. 18-year-old Owen Hewitt and Samuel Lux, aged 17, have been found guilty of arson and manslaughter. A third teenager, 18-year-old Ryan Croft, pleaded guilty to the crime. He was sentenced to 5 years. Mary Fox's daughter, Morwenna Can Fox, spoke outside Truro Crown Court.
Since November the 5th, 2009, our life has been turned upside down. We lost our mum, Mary, so suddenly and tragically.
Barack Obama has arrived in Louisiana to visit the areas worst hit by the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. The US president's been accused of not doing enough to tackle the disaster. Former Deputy PM John Prescott, ex-Tory leader Michael Howard and former Northern Ireland First Minister Ian Paisley are among more than 50 senior figures elevated to the House of Lords. Also on the honours list are kids TV presenter Floella Benjamin, who's been made a Liberal Democrat peer. And England have made a breakthrough against Bangladesh at Lord's. The visitors now 127-1 a short time ago. Earlier, England made 505. That's the latest. I'm Sean Allen Moy.
Is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
You think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Visit our website www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612-0225.
Arnold Services. Don't miss the opportunity. If you are employed and do extra hours work, bank shifts or overtime, including a second job, you are likely to have overpaid taxes. If you don't fall into any of these categories, you are still likely to have overpaid taxes based on your job expenses. We act as tax agents and can claim back £800 to £1,100 and up to £3,000 if you have never claimed before. Telephone 0845 544 0834. Visit marnor.net. M-A-R-N-O-R. Email admin@marnor.net.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Bank Holiday Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling, and my guest to review this week's news in Bristol, Britain and around the world is Labour councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. After the 6 o'clock news, author of the Police Federation's Tetra report, Barry Trower, will be here to discuss the safety or otherwise of mobile phone and wireless network, that is called electrosmog by many, with the BCFM's Steve Satan. And delayed from last week, we hear a lucid Michael Jackson speaking about music industry executive Tommy Mottola in 2004, around about the same time as the Sun newspaper tapes from a few weeks ago, which make Michael sound, or at least attempt to, like a drugged-up lunatic. That's in the second hour. Well, onto this week's news in a minute, but first, here's our two-weekend weather forecast from MetCheck.com. This weekend, averaging 16 degrees Celsius, so although it's sunny, not quite so warm as last weekend, and fairly wet tomorrow, unfortunately. Dry, though, with sunny spells on Sunday and Monday. Next week, averaging 20 degrees Celsius, so it's lifting up the temperatures a little bit and warming up and getting sunnier as the week goes on. Next weekend, that's the 5th and 6th of June, averaging around 11 degrees Celsius. Sunny spells on Saturday and wetter on Sunday. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from MetCheck.com. Well, on to our look through the week's news now, and with me is Labour councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. Hello, Ron, and welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening.
Now, first of all, the election, how did it go? Where were you?
Well, I was in Bristol East. I was the agent for Stockwood, Brissington East and Brissington West, and I worked to campaign in Brissington East to take the seat off the Tories, which I'm happy to say that we did.
Now, the Labour leadership is really more... actually, before we talk about that, what about the elections itself? Because there were a few problems this year, weren't there?
Yes, there were, and I've brought a report that I've given to the Chief Executive, because all councillors have been asked and all activists have been asked to comment. And first thing I'd say is that in Brissington East, there was the idiocy of using one polling station to take part of Brissington West. And on the morning, I did say to the returning staff that they'd have a problem in the evening with very little space and ballot boxes close together and votes being mixed up.
Well, it's worked quite well in the past elections. Why was it... Who decided to change things?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it depends on availability of venues, obviously. My choice would have been to have gone to St Cuthbert's Church for the Brissington West one and separated the two. I mean, on the night when the poll was very heavy, clearly voters put their votes in the nearest ballot box, and that's how the confusion arose.
Okay, so overall it was quite good near to you for your party, for Labour. What do you put that down to?
Well, I think it was the fact that the core Labour vote usually does turn out in a general election, but also I think there was a realisation of the candy floss of the opposition parties, the shallowness of the Tory offer, and the fact of the danger of what was likely to be lost by people that are in vulnerable positions, particularly on council estates.
Now, I know this week, on Monday, earlier this week, there was a special meeting at the council house, wasn't there?
Asking
people to come in who'd had problems with the election, so they could really just put together a sort of debrief, really, and find out where the problems had been and, you know, who'd been affected, if it had actually been that some people hadn't actually been able to vote. So did you make it to that?
I didn't make it to that, and that's why I've given a written report of my experiences and what I thought would improve the situation.
Well, if anyone out there did have problems and hasn't yet fed back, there is on the Bristol City Council's website, which is bristol.gov.uk, an electoral monitoring form, and they're asking people to go on there and put that in. But also there is another public meeting coming up in the near future, and they're collecting feedback. This inquiry, which has been organised by the Chief Executive, is going on until the 18th of June. So you have until the 18th of June to contact the Council. You can, of course, call them on the phone on 0117 922 2000 and speak to, I think, is it Electoral Services?
Correct.
Ron? If anybody out there still hasn't reported back having problems with the local election. Right. Moving on to the Labour leadership, and this is, I think, a fascinating one. Now, I don't know whether I should tell you who is the only one of the candidates so far that stepped forward that strikes me as a real proper human being, but there's, I think, there's about six or seven now, aren't there?
Yes.
And I say that a little bit flippantly, but there's only the only one I've seen so far that seems to make any very much sense to me is John MacDonald. What about you, Ron? What are your thoughts on the various contenders for the Labour leadership at the moment?
Well, I think there's a number that probably three in the end will come through with sufficient support from the parliamentary party to be real candidates for the autumn election.
So can you just explain how this works? The various people that want to put themselves forward as leader have to then go around and get existing Labour MPs
yes.
to sign up to their leadership
22, bid. I think it is.
Yeah.
33. Oh, sorry, 33.
33
in March. That's why it's so difficult for them to get on the ballot.
This is Martin Summers here. So Ron, what about your choice? Come and give us a bit of a.
Well, I'm looking for somebody that at the minute I'm a bit open minded. John MacDonald is obviously the candidate of the left, which is where I've naturally been all my Labour support and time. But you've got to be in a position to be critical of some of the issues. that people will need to look at for Middle England as well in relation to holding that vote. And it's a question of how he comes across or presents himself, I think, in the next 6 months is critical for him. I wouldn't rule him out at the minute. I was a bit concerned at the beginning that we might have a coronation of two, which doesn't look as though that's going to happen now. There's obviously the Miliband bandwagon, and I think the older brother of the two is probably the more polished of the two. Diane Abbott is not a candidate of the left as far as I'm concerned. I think she's a cursory candidate who's put herself in there. And I think with her exploitation of the national media late night on politics shows, I think she's a shallow candidate and wouldn't get my support. The other guy that's in there from the ex-health minister, he seems to be a genuine person, but I think, again, is sort of somebody that nobody knows.
I'm glad to hear you say genuine person, because, I mean, you know, I sometimes do think that some of these candidates, they put themselves forward, and I, with a journalistic eye, will look at it, and I'm sure millions of other people out there...
Who are we talking about here that nobody knows?
Andy Burnham, I think.
Andy
Burnham,
is that what we're talking about?
But I mean, the point being that it's, you know, that some of the people who put themselves forward, I see them, I see straight through them. They don't look to me as if they're really sincere candidates. No. I mean, it's not obviously just the Labour Party that these politicians are in. Yeah. So, ultimately, who do you think is actually going to win, Ron? Never, you know, notwithstanding who you're going to vote for. Very good.
I think it will be Miliband versus probably Ed Balls.
Okay.
If I had an open choice from the past candidates and the cabinet, I would have put up John Healey, the ex-housing minister.
But there's a bit of a mystery as to why Harriet Harman wasn't standing, wasn't it, as well? No?
I don't know. Maybe she's decided that time is enough. Maybe she was seen to be too close to Gordon Brown, etc., etc. I don't know.
Right, let's bring in Martin Summers, our old Labour Oxford economist, who's here too. Now, Martin, what about you on this Labour leadership? Who's going to win?
Well, I find myself, surprisingly, in broad agreement with what Ron's just said. I mean, John McDonnell would be my kind of choice, but I recognise that the Labour Party is a broad church, and that if he couldn't unite both wings or all factions of the party, he's not really a suitable leader. And of course, we've got to think about what Middle England makes of our stance and so on. But I think what will possibly change the situation is if this economic crisis really kicks in over the summer. What the Labour Party as a whole has to do is be the voice of those people who are opposed to the insane deflationary policies that are coming down the line from the coalition government, from the International Monetary Fund, from Washington, from Wall Street, all wrong, and somebody's got to stand up and say the emperor's got no clothes. So whoever the Labour leader is, they've got to be able to do that.
So who do you think will be able to make the best job of that, Martin, from your point of view as a Labour
expert? That's where I think John might come through from the back, because of course the vote isn't just the parliamentary party.
No.
It's also the trade unions, who are the funders of the party, and the constituencies.
It's not really very democratic, is it? You've got a few trade union leaders who've got these massive block votes.
No, it's the members.
Vote. It's the members get the vote.
Individual members do.
Yes.
It? Okay.
Yes. So it's a bit cumbersome, but you know what it does. In fact, it's not the the problem is there's a choke point at this stage, so the parliamentary party can decide who goes on the ballot by not endorsing or endorsing whoever they want. In the past, they used to just have the parliamentary party to decide, and it was, you know, the franchise was extended. But of course, the likelihood is that we will get two basically establishment candidates decided by the PLP, and then the activists and the unions will be left to choose between them. That is a bit of a problem.
So there's basically three sort of different areas of people who will be voting for it once the actual candidates who've managed to get enough nominations are known. That's MPs, party members, and union members of unions who are affiliated.
They all get a third of the final electoral
college.
So there's
a third for each of those. Right. It's the electoral college system. Right, okay. Well, we'll see. And when is the result going to be known? Do we know yet?
By Labour conference opening, unless the government's collapsed before that.
Okay. Which is when, Rob?
Imminent.
Okay. Well, let's have a look at some of this week's stories anyway. And first of all, we're starting off with the London bombings. And survivors and victims' families from the London bombings held a press conference last Friday. I just managed to miss it, unfortunately, but we're going to have some this week, to express their dismay that they will still not get answers to their questions. There will be no public inquiry, apparently, and into these attacks still after 5 years plus, and MI5 will be allowed to give secret evidence. And there won't be a jury at the inquests. Is MI5 above the law? Anyway, let's have a listen now to a little extract from that press conference held by survivors of the London bombing. London bombings in July 2005. And just to make it clear that the families of the victims are the ones who will be going along to the inquests, but the survivors apparently are getting no voice at all.
We hope now that the Home Secretary will withdraw her opposition to a judicial investigation, and that at last the survivors, all of those affected by the London bombings, will be able to have the answers they want. There is relief that she has adjourned the inquests, or the decision into whether to resume the inquests of the bombers, so that these 52 inquests will now take place without the inquests of the other four being joined to them. And it's right to say, finally, that there is a degree of disappointment. That disappointment comes from the survivors. The survivors were forced into a campaign for an inquiry simply because successive Home Secretaries refused it. An awful lot of pain and grief could have been avoided if 3 years ago, when we first asked for it, the government had decided to hold a public inquiry. But there is now a relief that the inquest will be held. They wanted to play a more active part in it. But they have been told that they cannot do so. And you may remember at the conclusion of the preliminary hearings, Rachel North, who had been one of the many campaigners for an inquiry, asked for a statement to be read out, and I will read to you, if I may, one paragraph from it, because this sums up, I think, the views of each and every one of the survivors. She said this: "It appears to me that if you are a member of the public who is unfortunate enough to survive a terrorist atrocity, then no matter how much your pain, your physical and or mental injuries cause you, no matter how much your life is blighted, no matter how much your health, career, personal life, relationships, family, sense of self is affected, no matter whether you become suicidal, no matter how much your life is changed, reduced and damaged, you will have no right to ask questions about what happened to you and to expect answers to be given to you. You may be called as a witness for the benefit of others, but that is all. You may not see documents or ask questions. You may not expect a public inquiry. You should just be quiet and be grateful that you are alive." Gentlemen, ladies, that's all I want to say. I will take questions. More importantly, it's the views of those sitting alongside me that you want to hear, and they have agreed to take questions from you.
Alistair Bunk of Sky News. Perhaps we can pick up on the final point you made there, and I address this question to the survivors. You're not going to be able to have legal representation at the inquest. What do you feel that you would have brought to the inquest had that decision been your own?
We have questions that need answering. We were allowed to submit some questions to the Intelligence and Security Committee, but those questions were not answered. We want assurances about recommendations that will be made. We have our role now will be one of answering questions only, which we will do willingly, but our questions are not going to be answered unless they're asked by someone else who's one of the bereaved. We've been shunted aside by officialdom, and those questions may or may not be answered. And those questions need to be answered because it does involve the safety of everyone who travels on public transport or goes to any public place.
So do you feel the inquest would be less effective as a result?
I hope it won't be. I really hope it won't be. And it's very important that we'll remember that the inquests are for the families and the loved ones of those who died. But this is our only voice. We've been led to believe that this would be an opportunity for us to have a voice, and now we don't.
So pretty harrowing account there. Martin, do you want to start here? Because the survivors are basically saying that they have a whole load of questions they want answered, not least of which is why there was so little information the first week afterwards, and many of the families will be talking about that as well. Why haven't their questions been answered, and why aren't they being answered?
Well, the excuse at the time, as Tony Blair, as the Prime Minister at the time, said, any inquiry will be a ludicrous diversion, his words, from supposedly criminal investigations into what was going on. You and I know that a film was made by a colleague of ours, Adrian Connick, called Mind the Gap, a film which was distributed on the internet, which questioned the official story of what happened on the day, and that led to yourself and myself being in the Conspiracy Files programme done by BBC Two in July of last year, examining the various theories that are floating around about what actually happened on the day. I think we need an inquiry. But there's obviously a question about whether any inquiry is going to get to the bottom of what may or may not have happened. In Ireland, the Pat Finucane Centre, which coordinates a group called Relatives for Justice, have been pushing for inquiries into various atrocities that went on during the Troubles. But they don't want a British inquiry because they don't trust a British inquiry under the current rules to get to the bottom of it. And of course, one of the major atrocities they're looking at is the bombings of Dublin and Monaghan in 1972, which the Garda Síochána believe were carried out by British intelligence agents, or help at least facilitated by British intelligence agents. In fact, 26 people died. In Bologna in 1980, the bombing of Bologna railway station killed 86 people, which was more people than were killed in London. And a parliamentary inquiry by the Italian Parliament uncovered the fact that their own secret services, in cahoots with the CIA and MI6, looks as if they were responsible for that. Nothing was ever been done about those things. We uncovered, when we were making the film, as you know, that the train that the bombers were supposed to have caught, which the government had said they got the train from Luton and they arrived at such and such a time at King's Cross, we through our investigations showed that that train did not run, and John Reid had to make a statement to the House of Commons saying that in actual fact they got all that wrong. But I would suggest, what sort of police investigation is it that doesn't establish a basic timeline of what happened on the day 6 months after the event? All of these questions are in the air. What many in the Muslim community fear, as we know because we spoke at Birmingham Central Mosque last year, what many in the Muslim community fear is that what is going on here is a strategy of tension, as we saw in Italy in the 70s and the 80s, whereby terrorist events take place, directions are pushed, and in actual fact the whole thing is being orchestrated from behind the scenes. Now, I'm not saying that is what's happening, I'm just saying that's a possibility, and plenty of them in the Muslim community are willing to accept that possibility. And as somebody who's looked into these things over many years, I'm another one of those people that accept that possibility. I'm not saying that's what did happen, I'm just saying that is the possibility. And certainly many in the Muslim community who come from Pakistan, where all these kind of very shady events go on all the time, they certainly suspect that. Now, whoever carried out the bombing was a terrorist. We've just got to find out who they really were.
Now, what about you, Ron? Don't you think it's 5 years ago now? Don't you think it's time to just move on?
Well, no, I don't. I don't think that you can stand back and allow suppression of the truth or finding the truth to a public outrage. It doesn't matter how long it takes, in my view. I listened to that press conference. I've never heard that before. That's a very moving and a very disturbing comment by that lady. I think she made her points very powerfully. And looking at another incident, and again, suppression of the truth, at the De Mendes shooting, where they shot an innocent man. And when the inquiry looked into that, where they were actually staked out, watching the wrong person, and then acted and then shot that person, I think that is absolutely dreadful. And the other thing you've got to remember is when you get a serious incident in your own life, it's as simple, if I could say that, as burglary. The impact on people's lives is huge. The fact that some people travelled on public transport and were nearly blown to bits and killed obviously affects people's lives for the rest of their life. And I think that if these survivors haven't got the ability to have a full and active 100% equal is to the families input into that inquiry, then I think there is a suppression of something going on in the truth, and somebody is being protected. I don't know what, and I think it's wrong. I know it looks like conspiracy theory, but I believe that we must protect public safety in this country at whatever level.
Well, they're running 52 separate inquests, which to me is inexplicable, because even in the Coroner's Act it says, well, if you've got lots and lots of suspicious deaths at the same time, as in a train crash or whatever, you have a public inquiry. And yet in this case they've decided to have 52 separate inquests, so I would imagine that you're going to have quite a lot of the witnesses literally having to turn up and speak 52 separate times at 52 separate inquests. Very strange.
Not normal procedure, as you just pointed out. Not normal procedure at all. Just as after David Kelly died, instead of having a coroner's inquest, we had a public inquiry, which many regard as a whitewash. Now, why wasn't normal procedure followed in both cases? It's bound to raise suspicions. And talking about conspiracy theory, if you like, within the Muslim community, many people do not believe the government's story about what happened. Now, if you want to stop future terrorist incidents, you've got to have confidence. We've got the Police Service of Northern Ireland now. It's got confidence of both sides of the community, and that's taken a long time to get that. Now, we mustn't lose the confidence of the Muslim community in the forces of law and order in this country, and that means that we must stick to the book all the way. Why aren't we sticking to the book?
Well, the other problem here is that they're not having any juries at these inquests, because MI5 have said that they will not actually come along to the inquests and give any evidence because their evidence is secret, because it may go to members of the public on a jury. And so the coroner has agreed to that and said, OK, we'll hold all these inquests with no jury.
Well, I mean, it's just not following the book, is it? Why isn't MI5 responsible to the law? They should be. And that's as simple as that. I mean, many people in the Muslim community, I'm not saying that they're right, but many people suspect MI5's hand behind these bombings. Now, how are they to clear their name if they won't come and speak in public and say what they're up to and who they are and who they're accountable to? And if you say that's carrying things too far, the MI5 wouldn't do things like that, lots of people in Belfast believe that they do as well, and that it's not just Muslims.
OK, Ron, I'll let you have the final word on this one.
Well, I mean, obviously my colleague's got far more experience and history of this, but I come back to the basic point that public safety has got to be the first issue, and the real truth in relation to serious outbreaks like this has got to be done by the book. We can't do this, otherwise speculation runs rife, and who knows what the truth is.
Well, we'll be having another look at the fallout, I suppose, from the London bombings of the 7th of July 2005 here on this programme on the first Friday in July, just before the anniversary. Our next story, Vince Cable is apparently a little bit of a naughty boy, according to Jeremy Paxman. The business secretary hasn't appeared all that much in public since the election, and here he explains why he is now supporting Chancellor George Osborne's $6.2 billion proposed spending cuts immediately, despite saying the complete opposite during the general election campaign. Mr. Cable told Jeremy Paxman that he changed his view because of the economic crisis in Europe.
Well, we're joined now by the Business Secretary, Vince Cable. You sat in this studio many a time during the election campaign and said now wasn't the time for cuts. When did you decide precisely that you were wrong and George Osborne was right?
I don't think it was right or wrong, but certainly I changed my view, and I changed my view because the facts, the evidence changed, and the evidence centred on the crisis in Europe around sovereign risk, and particularly Greece.
You said there were five reasons for not cutting immediately. They were unemployment, they were growth, they were spare capacity, they were availability of credit, and the fifth one is the one you're referring
to now, which is
international conditions.
And it's a crucial one, because if we do lose creditworthiness, the crisis is potentially much worse.
When precisely did you decide that international conditions meant that cuts had to be implemented as soon as you took office?
I think the precise moment was when we had the judgment of the Governor of the Bank of England,
On what date?
I think it was round about, was a day or so after the general election, because that was when the crisis in Europe was unfolding. And he's an absolutely key figure in this. Not is he just the country's top economist, but he sits as chairman of the Monetary Policy Committee, therefore for interest rates. So my view throughout, and as I communicated in interviews with you, is that we had to base our judgments on evidence. There were a series of factors. One of them, it turned out, was crucial because of this evolving crisis in Europe. We had to react to it.
At that point, you decided that you were wrong. So had this the people of this country elected a Liberal Democrat majority government on May the 7th, on May the 8th or May the 9th, you would have done precisely the reverse of what you said you do while campaigning.
No, when I was campaigning, I said we would make our judgments on the timing of cuts, on the facts and evidence available.
You said was wrong to do so now.
It was wrong.
The debate was the Bank of England governor making a statement.
But reacting to events that, I mean, what has been happening in Western Europe and international markets in the last few minutes is enormously important.
Do you admire George Osborne now?
It's not admiration. He's a colleague. We have a very good business-like relationship, and that's the way it will remain.
You could say, yes, I do admire him.
Look, I'm not paying compliments or criticising colleagues. We've got a very good, amicable, business-like relationship.
But you no longer take the view that his only experience of the world was paying the Bullingdon Club.
Yes, well, we had plenty of banter in both directions, and that was an election, and that was good sport on both sides, and we made our points in different ways. But we're now colleagues. We've got a coalition government, first in 65 years, a completely different political environment, and I think actually the public rather like the idea of these parties working together rather than the traditional tribal politics. Because it is an emergency.
It is very, very early days, isn't it?
It is.
And they don't know what will be the consequences of the decisions you've announced today.
They don't, but
they might come to hate you.
All the evidence that you presented a few months ago was totally negative. In my department, which has taken a big hit, we've made a big contribution to these cuts.
That was Jeremy Paxman speaking earlier this week to Vince Cable. Martin, do you want to just start with your comments on that? I mean, it's quite strong, isn't it, that Paxman there is saying that people may come to hate Vince Cable?
Well, he's clearly... I mean, let's get this clear. All three party leaders were saying that there would have to be cuts sooner or later. I don't think that was right. What it did was close the debate down about what the crisis is really about, in my view. We've all got convinced ourselves that because the markets want cuts, that's what we've got to do. These are the same markets that we bailed out 2 years ago. And if we hadn't bailed them out, they wouldn't exist to make these demands.
Isn't the political reality, though, that the markets actually do dictate much of what politicians
indeed,
do?
Indeed they do. And that's one of the problems. So Vince Cable can stand in the election saying he's not going to do the cuts, and as soon as he gets there, he ends up doing them. The same would have been true had the Labour Party won the election, I'm sad to say. We've got a fundamental problem with a lack of democratic accountability and control of the financial oligarchy in the Western world. It's a real problem. They've caused the mess, and now they're going to make the rest of society pay for mopping it up whilst they carry on cleaning up. Now, at some point, people are not going to tolerate this, especially as cuts will not reduce the deficit. As you cut, as we saw in the 1980s, as you cut, what happens is your tax receipts go down, your welfare payments go up, and you end up with a bigger deficit. And at that point, you do have a run on the pound. So I cannot see that there's any sense in cutting at all. We need a European-wide recovery programme based upon extra spending, and if we can't fund that through deficit, then it's got to be funded by getting the money off the people who made money during the bubble. First of all, through fraud investigations of the banks and the hedge funds, and putting people in prison and taking all their assets off them, raising taxes on property because property can't run away, and that's where. And it's an emergency, as Vince just said, just like World War II, and therefore the wealthy classes are going to have to get their checkbooks out. That's the way to resolve the crisis, not by cutting schools, hospitals and frontline services.
Well, what are your thoughts, Ron, on Vince and his U-turn?
Well, I'm hardly...
He doesn't really have a lot of choice, does he? I mean, he's got to go in with this coalition.
Well, I think he does, for many of the reasons that, again, you've just heard. Quite honestly, in relation to what he could or couldn't do and cuts, I think there is areas in public expenditure locally, for example, that could have been cut out and never should have been started, and that's like the regional FIRA HQ. You know, 3 years in the making, costing millions, a week, and we didn't need it.
Yes, but that was all done under your watch, the Labour, the Labour watch.
I know that, and I openly admit that. But it, again, as a member of the Fire Authority at that time, we never signed up to it because it wasn't needed. So there are things, I think, in public expenditure that you can do. But I think where Vince Cable and I fall out and the coalition fall out completely is that it will not be the well-heeled that get hammered in this. It's going to be the people that desperately do need help, support, advice, welfare benefits, assistance back into work, training, etc. And that's the very areas that's going to be cut first. And it's not going to be the large bonuses to bankers or the ability to take all your assets offshore and pay no tax at all and all that sort of thing. That's what we should be closing down on first, not on people in need.
Right, we'll be talking about that again in a little while. But first, back to BBC Six Music. Now, there was a protest organised by the National Union of Journalists and by various groups on Facebook this week outside the BBC on White Ladies Road at lunchtime on Tuesday about threatened job cuts within the BBC and the rather strange decision to kill off the BBC's award-winning digital channel Six Music. Now, I was down there and I chatted to various people who were there as part of the protest to find out what it was all about.
Listen to it online if you do like listening to things online. A lot of people don't, but you can connect your computer up to your amp and you can listen through it that way, or you can buy a digital radio. Or but you can't. There's no other way that you can get it, and I think that's probably one of the reasons why not many people listen to it.
What is it that you like about Six Music? Why are you so annoyed that it's being cancelled, got rid of?
It's such an eclectic style of music. You've got Steve Lamacq on there who plays all the new bands, gives you an opportunity to listen to all new music from all around the country. They go around the country, they focus on specific cities, for example. They talk about different venues in Bristol that you can go to and things that bands that people have seen in those particular venues. And it's just, advertising music for music's sake rather than for a commercial world and making money off the commercial world. And they've said that one of the reasons what they'll close Six Music for is because they can make it better commercially, but they won't be able to make it better commercially because it's money-driven, it's money-focused, and it's all about having your adverts in there. And the DJs on there, they just won't know this kind of decent music that people are playing.
My name's Matt. I'm here to support the Save Six Music campaign. It's a fantastic radio station. It plays music that doesn't really get profile anywhere else in UK radio. It's got fantastic presenters, and generally it has a passion for music that's unmatched by any other kind of BBC radio station.
Well, now, Radio Bristol, which many people listen to around here, has a computer that chooses its music for most of the daytime presenters. What's the difference between that and what you like on Six Music?
Six Music's playlist is very varied. I mean, it can come from modern day music that's coming out at the moment, going straight back to the 60s, 70s. It's basically just offers a range of music that is second to none. Well, there's kind of commercial radio is very obviously tied to kind of making money to survive. So I can understand in certain sectors they need to play the music that's most popular. But with something like BBC, who is obviously funded completely differently, Six Music is something that kind of sits outside that, and I think we should really cherish it rather than see it go by the wayside.
So is this just part of a wider campaign?
Yes, there's flash mobs taking place.
What's a flash mob?
When loads of people turn up in a certain place at a certain time. There's flash mobs in London today, Newcastle, Nottingham, all over the place, outside of regional BBC headquarters.
And then what is this going to do to actually keep the station? Because ultimately the BBC are just going to turn it off, aren't they?
Well, hopefully not. There's been enough protest over the past few months to give the impression that many, many people want it to stay alive. So hopefully they'll take note and won't close it down.
Yeah, Ben Prater from BBC Radio Bristol. Just to show a bit of support, really. It's the thought of people losing their jobs when their performance is good and listeners and TV viewers are tuning in. Yeah, just to show a bit of a support, really. You know, things like Six Music, so popular and won awards at the recent Sonys, and still the BBC wants to close it down. I know it's tough out there and everyone's got to justify their jobs, but it just doesn't seem to add up what they're proposing, really. I think the BBC is under the cosh a bit at the moment, and in many eyes it can do no right, and it does an awful lot of right.
But many people will say the BBC has got so many music channels, it doesn't need these extra ones.
People that make the decisions will ultimately do that, but I think you've got to stand up for what you believe in the first place, really, so you can sleep at night.
Do you ever actually listen to Six Music?
It's amazing how many friends of mine in their 30s, 40s, my old man as well, they tune in and listen.
I'm Christina Zaba. Until this January, I was chair of the NUJ in Bristol for 4 years. And I'm here because I'm supporting the BBC in their fight for jobs.
The BBC is really insulated from the recession because of its funding, isn't it?
Well, it should be, shouldn't it? But actually, they're being balloted concerning BBC management's attempts to force through compulsory redundancies. Why is it happening? It seems to me that, generally speaking, in the media, as technology gets more competent, people get more disposable. And I wouldn't like to say that BBC management are being cynical about this, but, you know, our view in the trade union movement generally is that people and their jobs matter. So I would like the BBC management to think in those terms. Six Music is the channel that caters for the kind of music that other channels don't cater for. Six Music is hugely popular. There are more than a million listeners now to Six Music, and the reason is that people appreciate the diversity and complexity of the music that it's on offer. I keep Six Music on all the time, and I'm always interested in what goes on there.
Hi, I'm Paul Breeden. I'm the acting chair of Bristol Branch NUJ, and I'm here with lots of colleagues from the union today because we're very worried about the impact of cuts on the BBC. It's not only a threat to the BBC Asian Network and Six Music, which a lot of people are angry about, and we've seen several listeners turn up here today, but we also fear that there'll be lots of job cuts across the BBC, which will affect the quality of programming for everyone.
Yes, but there's a recession right now, and the commercial sector is having to cut back. Why shouldn't the BBC do it too? Because if they don't, then it's just an unfair competition, isn't it?
The BBC is an extremely popular collection of media, and it's trusted by the people, and it's filling gaps that the commercial sector just won't fill, which is exactly what the Asian Network and Six Music do. There are a lot of things that if the BBC doesn't do, no one will.
I'm Ruth, and I live in Bristol, and I just came up because I'm concerned about the cuts in the radio stations.
For many people haven't heard the Six Music. Can you just tell us what it sounds like?
It plays an eclectic mix of music. I like the delivery style of a couple of the DJs particularly. It's a really nice station to just pop on.
But why don't you just listen to Radio 1? That's easier to get, isn't it?
I just don't like the music that they play as much. The kind of selection isn't as interesting. I bought a digital radio specifically so I could get it. I guess you can get it on internet as well. There's not many other stations I'd listen to on the digital radio, so to be honest, if we lose six music, then I'd just give it away or something.
I'm Vince Ball. I'm a Radio 6 listener, and I'm quite concerned that the nature of the cutting, but I'm quite concerned that they've muted the idea of cutting Six Music.
Well, I think it just gives a showcase for the kind of music you wouldn't get on mainstream radio stations, and even the BBC mainstream radio stations.
Well, don't you think really it's not really justified to have something which is so specialist? The BBC is there to serve the whole public, not just people who are interested in specialist music.
I always thought that was heartland BBC territory, you know, the specialised aspect of broadcasting, the things that which maybe wouldn't be commercially viable, which you've still got a large minority to play to. That's what I would say the BBC was for. Okay, that's the whole point of public service broadcasting, as far as I'm concerned, really.
So are you a bit puzzled then about why the BBC are doing this?
I'm completely puzzled, especially when I've seen the budget figures as well. I mean, the budget for BBC and Asian and the Asian station, I would say, are negligible compared to as a percentage of the overall budget. It's Jonathan Ross's salary, I would say, runs Six Music. I'm concerned about where the figures come from, for listening figures. I think where we're stood here, you'd be hard-pushed to walk from here to a mile to the top of this road, which is about a mile long, and find a fan of Chris Moyle's breakfast show on Radio 1. And yet, we're told it's the most popular programme on all the stations.
So do you question these radar figures, then, that the BBC go out and apparently they question lots of people and ask them what they're listening to?
I do, yeah. I do question them. I mean, I've never been questioned about my listening figures. I think I did get questioned once in about 1978 in Tottenham High Street. There weren't many radio stations then. There weren't very many commercial radio stations then either. So, you know, but that's the only time I can ever remember being surveyed about my listening habits. I'm sure as a middle-aged male jobbing builder, I'm down as a Coronation Street watching, I don't know, you know. I certainly wouldn't fit any of their models, I know. But for them to know that, they would need to question me, and they don't question me at all.
So you listen to a lot of radio while you're working?
Yeah.
Have you listened to lots of different channels, and you've decided on the Six Music being the best one?
Yeah, I would say so, yeah. And in fact, until Six came along, I would station hop a lot just to find something that I'd find agreeable, I suppose. But the thing I have issue with is radio's actual marketing. They seem to market to audiences in the daytime, which aren't there. Like, a big chunk of Radio 1's target audience is school children, and they should all be at school and not listening. Yeah, I find, especially with the BBC, their evening output is a lot higher quality than their daytime output. We're talking digital stations here, and a lot of people just still don't have digital radios, and that's a big problem as well, I think, trying to compare digital stations with broader spectrum broadcasts. From a figures point of view, it's just not a fair comparison.
Okay, now that was a protest that took place on Tuesday, sort of very gentle, peaceful one. Two police strolled by while I was there about BBC Six Music. Now, Martin, I know you listen to a bit of digital radio. Do you listen to Six at all?
I'm a bit more of a classical music listener during the day. I love all kinds of music, but I'm more of a Radio 3 man, I'm afraid.
And what about you, Ron?
Well, we've got a digital radio, but we keep trying to tune it in, and we find that we, in our position in Brislington, great difficulty in picking up many of the stations other than the main ones, unfortunately.
That's a pity, isn't it? Especially if everything's supposed to be switching over to this digital system. But one of the main points that came out of that was that, you know, there's the listing figures are based on everybody that's surveyed, and of course many people still don't have digital radios and don't listen to digital. So it's not surprising that the BBC is saying, well, there's not enough people listening to Six Music. All sounds a little bit strange to me. Anyway, that was merely mainly an opportunity to listen to what people had to say up there. The next story is something I put up on Bristol Indie Media yesterday, which is about the trees around Bristol. There's many trees have been pollarded this year, but the ones in White Ladies Road, I don't know if either of you two have noticed, haven't even come back yet. If anyone wants to see the pictures, I mean, you can, if you're not actually in White Ladies Road, you can have a look at bristol.indiemedia.org. But we're now at the end of May, and these trees still haven't had any leaves growing out of them at all, and they look rather sick and ill. Do you think there could be a problem here, Ron?
Well, as you know, I've campaigned about city's trees 3 or 4 years ago. Clearly, there is a programme of maintenance which has to be carried out. What has happened with some of the mature trees in the city is that some of them are apparently being attacked by either beetles and fungi, which we haven't had before, and that's a lot of that's been put down to climate change and troubles. But the ones, for example, along the river on the opposite side to Coronation Road, many of the trees had to be taken out there because they were dying from the roots, literally. Now, in relation to White Ladies Road, I don't know that, but clearly the work's been done, hopefully, to prevent either the top weight of the canopy from becoming too much, or indeed in relation to their stability, I suspect, from what I've had in the past. But clearly the climate that we've got and the type of weather that we've had, I think we are in for some failures, unfortunately.
Well, I'm not really an expert on trees, and I certainly haven't looked into it as much as Ron has. I just had a vision in my mind of George Osborne chopping all these trees down and saying, there, we've saved ourselves a few, Bob.
OK. Well, we have had a statement from the council from Helen Hewitt, who's a spokeswoman for Bristol City Council. She says, the trees on White Ladies Road have been pollarded and will be in leaf within the next 4 weeks, because at the moment there's actually no leaves at all on many of the ones on White Ladies Road. Pollarding of street trees helps to prevent electric wires and streetlights being obstructed. In Bristol, street trees are inspected every 3 years, and pollarding usually takes place every 3 to 5 years. So hopefully, within the next few weeks, those trees on White Ladies Road will have a few leaves on them.
Could I suggest you put your question to the tree forum that the City Council has?
And the City Council Tree Forum, fantastic. Yes. Where, who are they, and where can we find them?
You find them through the Parks Department.
Okay.
And that is open to the public, members of the area.
And the City Council has a tree officer, I believe.
Yes, Russell Horsey.
And so you can get hold of him through the Tree Forum.
Yes.
Now, you two, Martin particularly, mentioned to me just as we were coming in today that you heard some shots on Stapleton Road, at least that what apparently were gunshots. So, Martin, can you just tell us what you heard? And this was around about early afternoon, I think, was it?
Yeah, I was in my house, which is on Stapleton Road, my flat was on Stapleton Road, and I heard, it wasn't very loud for me because it was about 100 yards away, but it was basically a fusillade of shots. I didn't think anything of it. It was not so loud. I mean, I have heard gunfire because I used to be an aid worker in Bosnia, and it didn't sound like major gunfire to me, but it was gunfire, and I saw people running away, you know, mums with their kids in pushchairs just kind of getting out of the way. Some rather terrible incident seems to have taken place. I don't know anything more about it than that. I mean, Ron, you were on the, you heard it on the radio, something about it.
Yeah, I mean, we were driving back from Bath, and it's been given out as road closure is likely to be closed for most of the evening, I think. Very sad incident. I don't know what's been involved, no more than...
I'm afraid I can't fill you in either on any more about that, but I'm sure we'll be hearing more about it in the paper tomorrow or next week. Now, I'd just like to have a look at this another story, which is to do with badger culling this week. And yesterday, and this is in the Farmers Weekly, which is a publication we don't always look into, I must admit, every week here, and it says the Welsh Assembly Government said yesterday that three arrests have been made after contractors working on farmland near Newport, Pembrokeshire, have been subjected to harassment and intimidation by protesters opposed to the new badger cull. Contractors wore masks and balaclavas to protect their identity as protesters videoed them arriving to carry out survey work. But Assembly, that's Welsh Assembly staff who were with the contractors, were filmed and later found that the images had been posted on the internet. An Assembly government statement branded their behaviour unacceptable. Well, what are your thoughts, either of you, on the wisdom of this quite widespread badger cull to apparently prevent bovine TB, which has been mooted for about 4 or 5 years now?
Yes, I know, and there seems to be contradictory evidence on both sides to support one view or the other. I honestly can't see the direct link personally. I think a wholesale cull is something that I personally wouldn't like to see or support. I can understand the need to control numbers, but wholesale extinction is something that at this minute, it's personally, I find abhorrent.
Well, one of the main arguments is that, of course, if all the badgers are killed, then there are plenty of other animals that will then start to, if it is this is the cause of bovine TB, then we'll continue to carry the disease. But anyway, BCFM's Joanne Schofield was down earlier this week, spoke to Pauline Kidner down at Highbridge near Burnham-on-Sea at somewhere called the Secret World Wildlife Rescue Centre. And Pauline is really very adamant that this is a very bad idea, this badger cull.
My name is Pauline Kidner and I'm the founder of Secret World Wildlife Rescue. And the charity now has been running really purely on its own for 10 years. Originally, we were a dairy farm and we were made unviable by milk quotas that were introduced by the Conservatives in the 1980s. So we had to diversify and we decided to open the farm and show people where their food came from. And it was during that time, because of the way that we kept our animals, that people started to bring orphan and injured wildlife into us. And I became fascinated by wildlife and particularly by three orphan badger cubs that came into us in 1989. I suppose because I've got a farming background and we did ourselves have a TB outbreak ourselves, I wanted to know more and more about badgers. And over the years we came to rear a lot of badger cubs, and working with the central veterinary laboratories we realised that there was a test that we could use for our badger cubs, so that if we tested them three times we could then know that they were free of the disease when we released them back into the countryside. And because of this stringent protocol that we follow, we do have a lot of acclaim for our work with badgers, and really that's why I followed it so much, particularly with the bovine TB problem which has been rumbling on in the countryside for many, many years now. We started culling badgers in the 1970s, and we've done reactive culling, which is killing badgers where TB appears in cattle. We've done proactive culling, where you kill out as many badgers as you possibly can. And over the years, eventually, the government decided that this wasn't making any difference and they needed to do a proper research programme to find out exactly where badger culling played a part in the countryside. So a research programme was started in 1998. It went on for 10 years. 12,000 badgers were killed during that period of time. And they prove without doubt that reactive killing of badgers doesn't work, and neither does proactive killing of badgers either. In actual fact, it can literally make it worse because you cause dispersal from their social groups. It's quite complicated, and this is the problem that people find it hard to grasp the situation. But having spent £53 million on a research programme that lasted 10 years, the only thing that was wrong with that research programme was it came up with the wrong answer as far as the farming communities and the NFU was concerned. Badger culling doesn't work, and that's why Hilary Benn stood by that science last year. Unfortunately, we have the Welsh Assembly that are now going to do a cull really in a large area in Pembrokeshire and also some of the adjoining counties as well, and it's about to start now. And people have to realise that 1,500 badgers yet again are going to lose their lives, although from the research we know that stringent cattle controls can resolve the problem in the countryside. The killing of badgers is kind of being thrown in as a carrot for the farmers, because obviously it's one of those things that they've been told for so many years that badgers are part of this problem. The only problem now is that with the new government that we have, they also now have committed to bringing culling back, and they're watching the Welsh Assembly's programme. And so we really need to make people aware that badgers are losing their lives in Wales, and if they're allowed to continue with this, it will happen in England as well. I'm very involved with badgers. I am emotionally involved with badgers, but I've also followed this scientifically. And if it was found that badger culling worked, then I would accept that. And unfortunately, it is the case that it doesn't work. And I'm going to do as much as I possibly can to make people aware that badgers yet again are being used as a scapegoat, and there's going to be a lot of blood lost needlessly in the countryside.
What do you think the answer could be, possibly?
There is many things that were actually recommended when this research programme was finished by the Independent Scientific Group. We have many ways of controlling. A lot of it is down to movement of cattle. It's also to do with bringing in yearly testing rather than 3 and 4 yearly testing. And it's proved that cattle can move around and actually miss testing through the whole of their lifetime. It is a cattle disease, and we have a very bad test which towards the end of the disease, it doesn't actually pick up animals in the final stages. And with the BSE problem, where many cows were killed, and also the foot and mouth, this caused lots of cattle to be moved around the country, and because of the TB problem, it's been moved everywhere around the country. It really is a cattle disease, and we need to approach it from the cattle, not from wildlife. If we killed every badger in the whole of Great Britain, we would not get rid of bovine TB, because we then have a second vector, which is deer. Once it's out of the cattle, our wildlife will be free of it as well.
And that was Pauline Kidner, founder of the Secret World Wildlife Rescue Centre down by the M5 in Highbridge near Burnham-on-Sea there, talking about her thoughts about the wisdom or otherwise of the badger cull. Now, Ron, what are your thoughts about badger culling? And I know you said just say something a bit before we heard that, but after hearing Pauline there.
Well, like she said, the main research programme that went into it couldn't find a direct link, and I think she's quite right in pointing out things like foxes and other animals, birds, whatever. Once it gets outside of the actual cattle contact, what do you want to do? Slaughter the whole of the wildlife, and you know, for the benefit of the dairy farmers. I think you've got to keep a sense of perspective in this, and I think she's right. It's because it's turned out to be the wrong result.
Okay, final story. Bristol City Chairman leaves the UK to avoid taxes. Bristol City's Chairman Stephen Lansdowne has revealed he's moved to the Channel Islands in the wake of the government's decision to increase income tax for the super rich to 50%. Martin, do you want to have a really quick one on this? We've got about a minute to the news.
If the stock market and the banks had not been bailed out by the taxpayer 2 years ago, he wouldn't be worth this amount of money. He'd be bankrupt. So I think it's a damn cheek that these people have got.
Absolutely correct, and we should be able to stop this. It's immoral.
So maybe we'll withhold his passport or something?
Yes, if you want to leave the country, one of the things you might decide to do, if you want to leave the country, that will be it. You won't come back and your children won't go to school here, so no eating for you.
Okay, well, we're coming up to the Sky News at 6, thanks to this week's guest, Labour Councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. After the news, the author of the Police Federation's Tetramast Report, Barry Trower, discusses the safety or otherwise of mobile phones and wireless networks. So join us after the news.
It's run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.